Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to Working History, a podcast on the New Books Network channel, New Books in the American South. Working History is a production of the Southern Labor Studies Association. Learn more and become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org. I'm series host Beth English, and today I'm speaking with Ismael Garcia Colon, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the City University of New York, College of Staten Island. We're discussing his new book, Colonial Migrants at the Heart of Empire, Puerto Rican Workers on U.S. Farms, published by the University of California Press. Ismael Garcia Colon, welcome to Working History.
Thank you for the invitation.
Of course, my pleasure. One of the main themes that your book engages with is the multiple challenges faced by Puerto Rican farm workers in the United States because of their status as both U.S. citizens and, as you discuss, perceived, quote unquote, others. To start us off, could you give our listeners a very quick primer, if you will, on how Puerto Rico came to be a U.S. colonial territory and how its residents then were ultimately granted U.S. citizenship?
Yes, Puerto Rico became part of the United States in 1898 as a result of the Spanish-American War. Some people call it the Spanish-Cuban-American War. Mm-hmm. So the United States invaded Puerto Rico, and as a result of this war, the United States became an empire. Puerto Ricans initially were not granted U.S. citizenship. Mm-hmm. There was this fear that people of African heritage will be part of, will become part of the United States nation. So the Congress and the president, they didn't want to grant citizenship. In 1984, the U.S. Supreme Court declared Puerto Ricans national. Mm-hmm. That what that meant was that they were subjects of the United States, but not citizens, part of the United States for basically domestic purposes. Mm-hmm. And this happened when Puerto Ricans began to migrate to continental United States, right? That there was this question of what are we going to do with this new colonial subjects that we just acquire, and what is going to be the status of them? So initially, they were granted this national status. And in 1917, some people argue that the United States fear a German invasion of the island. Other people argue that the United States wanted to maintain Puerto Rico or Puerto Ricans as loyal subjects. Mm-hmm. And that was those were the reasons why Puerto Ricans became U.S. citizens. But in 1917, Puerto Ricans became naturalized citizens.
Okay.
Not native born mm-hmm. citizens. That happened until 1941. When they were included in the Immigration Act of 1940. And it wasn't until 1948 that Congress really clarified this status, because some people that were living out of the United States and out of Puerto Rico, they were basically stateless. Mm-hmm. And in 1948, Congress then clarifies that Puerto Ricans are native born.
Okay. So with that 1940-1941 shift from naturalized to native born, was that also a product of the wartime crisis that was starting in that moment?
Yes. Okay. I mean, the fear, again, that you needed to maintain this colonial subjects loyal to the nation was one of the reasons why they granted or extended the citizenship of Puerto Ricans. But it was also the lobby of the local colonial government with the federal agencies trying to give Puerto Ricans more rights within the U.S. nation.
Okay, that's interesting. When we think of Southern labor history, which this podcast focuses on, why is it important for us to, in your opinion, widen our circle to include places like Puerto Rico that might be seen as on the periphery of the U.S. South or of the global South, even geographically?
First, there has been a long time connection between Puerto Rico and the southern part of the United States. This is since Spanish colonial times. From Puerto Rico, some expeditions during the colonial times were launched to what is now the United States. And Puerto Ricans migrated to places like in Florida, Ybor City, to work in the tobacco in Ybor City, for example, in the 19th century. In the earliest 20th century, the first Puerto Ricans recruited by the United States Employment Service during the first war, they were sent to war-related industries in the South, Kansas, North Carolina, Louisiana, and many died there as a result of the Spanish flu in 1918.
Which seems suddenly relevant, right, in the moment that we're living in. Yeah.
Yes. And after the mid-20th century, farm workers that migrated without contracts, without any kind of contract between the government of Puerto Rico and farmers, they will first travel to Florida. And from Florida, they will trek north all the eastern seaboard, working in the harvest.
So basically what you're saying is that Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican workers have really been an integral part of Southern labor history right from the very beginning. So it makes sense to include them sort of in our scope of consideration. So let's really dive into your book a bit more and, you know, kind of fast forward a little bit from what you were talking about in terms of the Spanish-American War and then into 1917, and but not so far beyond when Puerto Rican citizens became official citizens, if you will, of the United States. And your book largely looks at the post-World War II period. So can we talk a little bit about, and can you tell us what, and you briefly just mentioned this before, but what was the farm labor migration to the U.S. like up to this time, so sort of in the pre-World War II period, and how were or were not, as the case may be, Puerto Rican workers, Puerto Rican farm workers specifically, part of this mix?
Well, as soon as Puerto Rico became part of the United States, labor recruiters landed in Puerto Rico, seeking Puerto Rican labor. Initially in 1899, labor recruiters from Hawaii was already part of the United States, and the sugar company sent recruiters to Puerto Rico for the sugar plantation. And it was because first the Japanese had created a monopoly of labor and they wanted to break that monopoly. And secondly, because of the Chinese Exclusionary Act. So the sugar planters were recruiting Puerto Ricans and from other places around the world. So this is when Puerto Ricans are nationals. U.S. companies are recruiting them to Hawaii, but also U.S. sugar companies in Cuba, Dominican Republic, and in some cases, in some plantations in Mexico. When they become citizens, they are sent to the South to these war-related industries. And in the 1920s, there's this recruitment of Puerto Ricans to Arizona and for the cotton plantations. But the problem was that they were already citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And they were promised things that were not true. And when they got there and they found the reality, they began to escape and leave the plantations for the cities. And mm-hmm. for the cotton planters, that was a disaster. And for them, since then Puerto Ricans were not a good source of labor.
Sure.
They began to complain. By 1928, in the hearings on immigration in the Western Hemisphere, farmers feared that the United States would restrict Mexican migration and that they would use Puerto Ricans and Filipinos. And so the farm lobby began to basically argue against Puerto Ricans because they were not deportable. Mexicans could be sent back if they were troubled. Puerto Ricans would stay and become country charges.
Mm-hmm.
So during the Depression, Puerto Rican labor was not basically used, and there are no recruiters to Puerto Rico. So in 1941, you have the Mexican Bracero program. You have also the United States recruiting West Indians to work in farms, but they are not recruiting Puerto Ricans. And the local colonial government is governor at the time, Rexford G. Togwell, one of the most radical New Dealers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Togwell is lobbying the Office of Territory for the use of Puerto Ricans, but the farmers didn't want them.
Mm-hmm.
And since the farmers were in the boards of the Manpower Administration, they were able to block Puerto Ricans. And Puerto Ricans were recruited, but to a lesser extent in manufacturing and the manufacturing sector,
mm-hmm.
and not in farm labor. The recruitment of Puerto Rican in farm labor in large quantities to continental United States began in the post-war years. In 1945, 1946, labor recruiters began to arrive in Puerto Rico, and they were bringing workers. But sometimes they would promise salaries that were not true.
Mm-hmm.
The conditions that they were offered were not adequate for the workers. And these workers began to complain to the local government in Puerto Rico. The governor of Puerto Rico then sent its Secretary of Labor, Fernando Sierra Verdecilla, to investigate this situation. And they found that it was true, that labor recruiters were abusing many workers.
Mm-hmm.
And the government of Puerto Rico then, in 1947, when the Mexican Bracero program is suspended temporarily,
mm-hmm.
the government of Puerto Rico then issues two laws. One law is Law 89 that restricts labor recruitment in Puerto Rico. Any labor recruiter had to be approved by the government of Puerto Rico, and Law 25 that created the Bureau of Employment and Migration,
mm-hmm.
basically the local U.S. Kind of employment service, the local employment service in the islands. And with that, the government then creates this farm labor program.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that impact farm labor migration to the United States once those laws were passed? Did it facilitate more migration or less, or did it just manage it in a different way?
Well, it facilitated migration from Puerto Rico to the Northeast.
Okay.
Because actually the government of Puerto Rico feared the Jim Crow South.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they basically stated, we are not going to send these workers to the South, not even Florida.
Okay.
And so the Puerto Rican migration to farm labor happens mostly to the Northeast. New Jersey and Southern New Jersey is still, from the late 1940s to the present, the center of Puerto Rican farm labor migration. So with that, what happened was that British West Indian farm labor migration gets restricted in the northeast of the United States because of Puerto Rican migration. In 1949, the Secretary of Labor, Fernando Sierra Verdecilla, reached an agreement with Robert Goodwin, the director of the U.S. Employment Service, to consider Puerto Rican domestic workers and grant Puerto Rican preference over what they call guest workers.
Okay. The farm workers themselves and their experiences are really central to the story that you tell in the book. And so could you, now that we have this framework of understanding the structure around, you know, how these workers are coming to the United States, could you walk us through what life was like for Puerto Rican farm workers in the U.S.? What sorts of work were they doing? You said they were coming to the Northeast largely. So what kinds of work were they doing? What were the conditions in which they labored? And, you know, anything else that you could tell us about their day-to-day lives, as you said, domestic workers from what was still in many ways considered a colonial outpost, if you will.
So Puerto Ricans, because they were migrant laborers, they wanted to work as many hours as they could so they could send money to their families. So most of them, to the present time, they work 7 days a week. Still, Puerto Rican farm workers, they work in a day from, say, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 12 hours a day, especially when there's the harvest is is very intense. And they will work until Sunday, maybe Sunday until 1 p.m. And they usually work in fruits and vegetables, but also in tobacco. And this depended in the region, right? You have in southern New Jersey workers in the vegetable harvest, also picking up blueberries. In the northern part of New York, you have workers picking up apples. In the Connecticut River Valley, you had a lot of Puerto Ricans. Workers in the tobacco farms. Puerto Ricans that work in the tobacco farms in Puerto Rico will migrate to tobacco farms in the Connecticut River Valley. It really depended on the region. Like in Long Island, in eastern Long Island, you have them harvesting potatoes. And, you know, this is a really intensive work, sometimes bending their backs most of the day, carrying heavy loads of produce. But most of them did this because they wanted to improve their lives. They tell me that they were looking for buen ambiente, meaning a good environment, a good life, right? So what I cover in my book is these feelings of hope that they had. And this hope of improving their life was what was driving them to migrate seasonally. Many of them had this idea that they will migrate, that is, they will get money, save money, and will be able to bring their families. And many did that. Many moved from the farms to the cities. Many kept moving back and forth and building their houses, buying land in Puerto Rico, opening small stores. But at the same time, they, you know, that they were working in this all the time. They felt like, many of them felt like living in a prison. And this is a topic that is recurrent in the interviews that I did, and actually in the documents and newspapers of since the 1940s through the 1980s, that the labor camps were like a prison for farm workers, and that they felt estranged from, you know, from Puerto Rico, right? They speak the language. Some of them were without any families or friends. So this dialectic between the hope and the estrangement what shaped their experience in U.S. farm labor.
Right. Looking at their experiences from a worker management perspective, what were relations like between the farm workers and the farm owners and operators? Is it sort of a classic, you know, labor management struggle, or was it different?
You know, there's positive and negative sides of the story.
Yeah.
In the case of farmers, it was sometimes a headache to deal with Puerto Ricans because they will leave their job without finishing the contract, breaking their contracts. But at the same time, in the documentation that I have found, there are many, many incidents of wage theft and complaints by workers. So the workers it was common for workers to complain about abusive relations with the farmers, the farmers abusing them, not providing them adequate living places or worker conditions that were acceptable. Mm-hmm. But in the other side, you know, I was able to interview workers in southern New Jersey that were migrating to the same farm that their parents or grandparents migrated in the 1950s.
That's interesting. Wow.
And I asked other farmers, and I said, how do you get your workers? Well, because my father used to bring them from this area in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, there are these long lasting relationships. Mm-hmm. And some workers will say, oh, because my boss, he has sent their children to Puerto Rico to spend the summer with my children. Hmm. Or the farmer speaks Spanish. Mm-hmm. They have, this bonds has been created between farmers and farm workers that, mm-hmm. in a way, are paternalistic, right? Because
sure.
The farmers make sure to maintain these sources of labor.
So, and this seems very different, very different in a lot of ways from other groups of farm laborers that come to the United States, particularly guest workers who don't have, it seems, a similar degree of agency that Puerto Rican workers do by virtue of the fact that they are deportable. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. What scholars Nicolas DeGeneva and Natalie Potts argue is that in the United States, there's this deportation regime. Mm-hmm. And this deportation regime also shapes the lives of U.S. citizens. So in the case of Puerto Ricans, this deportation regime shaped the relationship to farm labor. Sometimes I found this letter from the Attorney General of Pennsylvania in the 1950s complaining about the fact that Puerto Ricans would stay after the harvest. Mm-hmm. In other instances, farmers or the directors of labor camps will complain that Puerto Ricans could not be deported when they misbehave, mm-hmm. when they complain about the labor conditions. And they will say it clearly, you know, that they will prefer, for example, the British West Indians, because they could be deported, and they didn't want Puerto Rican farm workers. So Puerto Ricans were desirable when immigration restrictions were and still are imposed, mm-hmm. on guest workers, and they were undesirable when the country opened the doors to guest workers.
So it's sort of a double-edged sword, right? That, you
yes.
know, on one hand, they're desired, and the other hand, they're not. Okay,
yes.
So that's all very, very interesting. Before we wrap up for today, given the particular moment that we're in and the conversations around immigration policies that we're currently having, what do you see as an important takeaway or takeaways from the story that you tell in your book?
One thing is that if we wanted to understand the effects of open border policies, the case of Puerto Ricans in farm labor is a good way to understand the dynamics of having open border policies. Another aspect is that, unlike nativists argue, it's not the immigrants who we should blame for the situation of citizens. It's mm-hmm. actually elected officials and agribusinesses, mm-hmm. right, that don't allow workers to organize, to have labor unions, to have decent labor conditions, to have access to health care and a minimum wage in farm labor.
That's definitely giving us something to think about. And hopefully our listeners will pick up a copy of your book, which was just published last month. Am I right? So
yes.
It's very recent, but it's available. So thank you for taking the time to join us on this episode of Working History to discuss it.
Thank you again for the invitation.
Thanks again to Ismael Garcia Colon for joining us to discuss his book, Colonial Migrants at the Heart of Empire. And thank you for listening to this episode of Working History, a podcast on the New Books Network produced by the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member of SLSA online at www.southernlaborstudies.org and follow Working History on Twitter at Working History.